Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. U.S. Senator Kent Conrad has proposed spending $6 billion for a series of health co-ops across the country. Some are already in existence. Conrad proposes this as an alternative to the health care reform plan being proposed by President Obama. He proposes it as an alternative, a more cost-effective alternative, in his view, to the so-called public option. As I said, some health co-ops have been in existence for a long, long time. Co-ops have been in existence not only for health purposes, but also for farmers and for dairies. And with us today to discuss the co-op model and its possible applications, how it has worked for farmers, how it might work for healthcare, is Dr. Justin Gardner of the Department of Agribusiness and Agriscience. And before we get you into defining exactly what a co-op is and how it works, there was something, Justin, I understand you wanted to say right up front in expressing that this is not a political polemic that you're engaging in here.
That's right, Jenna. First of all, thanks for having me on. It's good to be back here interviewing with you. I want to, I guess, start with a statement of political neutrality. Mm-hmm. As a professor, as an economist, it's not my job to be a politician. And so I didn't come here today to talk to you about pros and cons of any particular healthcare plan. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to come talk about cooperatives and explain to your listeners what they are, what they can do, how they can fit into a lot of different situations. Mm-hmm. Being a professor, you never want a student to ever get the impression that their grade might be a function of my political beliefs, which is never the case.
Right. And as we are recording now, several aspects of both Conrad's idea and President Obama's idea are still in the mist, and we don't know what bill eventually will come out of Congress after 411 amendments are voted on anyway. So tell us a little bit about, let's just define our terms starting off. What is a co-op?
Well, the way I think about a co-op is a business that is owned by the users and controlled by the users, and the users receive the benefits of the business. Another way of thinking about it is that it's a business of the people, by the people, for the people, where the people are the people who use the co-op.
And how does it work in practice?
Well, first of all, co-ops in the U.S. are private businesses. They're not government-owned enterprises. Some people have that misconception. And the way I like to think about it, the way co-ops kind of get started, is you take a group of people who are sitting around and they observe a problem, and they decide to act together to solve the problem. Co-ops are not necessarily for profit. They're not designed in amongst themselves to make money. They're designed to provide services. They're designed to reach out to a specific population, a group of users, provide them something they maybe couldn't get on the open market, or couldn't get a fair price on the open market, and deliver it to them. And if they make a profit, well, that's great. They'll take that profit and turn it back to the users.
And we see co-ops for farmers and farm equipment all throughout rural areas and small towns. There's one here in Murfreesboro that's really not, it's right down the road from Middle Tennessee State. It's not too far away. And this works in terms of selling farm equipment, seed, fertilizer, that sort of thing, right?
That's exactly right. That's what we classify as a supply cooperative. This is a business that exists for the purpose of providing an input to this agricultural producer. We're talking about the Rutherford Farmers Co-op. This is a co-op that originally just served Rutherford County farmers, but it's expanded, merged with some adjoining cooperatives. They have a branch down in Cannon County, for example. And so this business is in the business of serving farmers. Farmers join the cooperative. They pay a membership fee. And if the cooperative is profitable, they get some money back at the end of the year. Now, anyone can go use the Tennessee Farmers Cooperative stores, the Rutherford Farmers Co-op. Anyone can go there and buy something if they want.
I can walk in and buy cucumber seeds
exactly,
or whatever.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And some terminology here. The person who uses a co-op, that's called a patron. A patron is the person who uses the co-op. And so the patron can be a member of the co-op, or it might not be the member. So because you're not a farmer, you can't join that co-op.
Mm-hmm.
But you can be a patron. Farmers who use the co-op can join it, and they're a member and a patron. The key difference here is the member gets to vote.
Do you have to be a farmer to be a member of a farmer's co-op?
Absolutely.
You absolutely do. And they have to have, I suppose, a specific definition for farmer, X number of acres.
Right. And the individual co-op gets to make that decision as how they want to define their potential members. These are, you know, private organizations that get to make these decisions among themselves.
Is it analogous to a credit union as opposed to a bank?
Yes, it is. Credit unions are sometimes classified as cooperatives.
Okay. Is the same model that is used for farmers' cooperatives applicable to providing health care services?
The same model is applicable to providing virtually anything. And it's used in numerous types of businesses, not just agriculture. There are cooperatives for housing. There are housing cooperatives. When I was in graduate school, several of my fellow students were a part of a housing co-op. They paid rent, and at the end of their time, they had actual ownership in the house and developed equity in this house. And so they could, in essence, sell off their membership to the next person who wanted to come move into the house after they graduated and moved on with their life.
In its applicability to healthcare, how would a bunch of people who want to form their own healthcare co-op go about doing it?
Well,
I mean, is it as simple as a bunch of people getting together in a room and saying, hey, let's elect a president, vice president, secretary, treasurer, board of directors, or do they have to file for nonprofits 501c3 status with the government?
Yes. Well, typically what we see in the U.S., typically cooperatives are types of corporations. And so like any corporation, you've got to be chartered. You've got to file for a state charter. You've got to do all this various paperwork. Lots of the same kind of effort you would put into starting a corporation will go into it. So basically you get a group of people together. They see some kind of problem they want to solve. They join together. Pull their equity, pull their resources, and start this business and go through the same paperwork process that a corporation will go through.
Okay. Is there a requisite number of people that you have in order to make a co-op work? Can it work in small groups as well as large groups?
That would depend, by and large, on what service the cooperative wanted to provide. For example, if a group of farmers wanted to get together and collectively start a co-op to buy a specific piece of equipment, say a cotton picker or something like that, and then share this piece of equipment inside that cooperative business, well, you just need enough people to get enough money together to pay for and justify operating this piece of equipment. And so as the business enterprise gets bigger, you need more people because you need more money.
Mm-hmm. Is Farm Bureau Insurance a part of a for-profit business, or is it a co-op?
The Farm Bureau is a co-op. And in fact, I've got some information on them, actually.
Okay.
Flip through my pages here of information. The Farm Bureau, the Tennessee Farm Bureau Federation, there's some kind of buzzwords that we see that every time you hear the word federation, you're mm-hmm. typically dealing with a co-op.
Mm-hmm.
A federated co-op is a co-op that has other co-ops as members.
Right.
The Rutherford County co-op here is a member of the Tennessee Farmers Co-op. So the Tennessee Farmers Co-op is a federated co-op and its members are other co-ops. So the Tennessee Farm Bureau Federation, they have their own health care coverage that they offer to their members. They've had this, they call it the TBF, the Tennessee TRH, Tennessee Rural Health is what they call it. It's been around since 1947, and they provide health care coverage to their members. So you pay a membership fee, and you're able to join the Farm Bureau and get your health care coverage through them. Originally, this started off as something primarily focused on farmers in rural areas, but if you've seen their ads on TV, they're running the you don't have to be a farmer to get Farm Bureau health coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And again, they've been doing this in this state since 1947. Some interesting things about the Farm Bureau here in Tennessee, my contacts there tell me they're the only state Farm Bureau that actually does this. They actually have their own insurance risk pool. They cover all the risks associated with covering people's health care in-house internally, and they They pass all the administration onto a third party. Blue Cross Blue Shield does all the administration work on that, but they actually do their own internal risk pooling, which is the really difficult and hard part of running any kind of a risk-bearing agency like an insurance company. That's where the real issues arise.
So in some aspects, it's like being self-insured. The group is quote-unquote self-insured, but on the other hand, the idea is to provide the value of group rates, which are always lower than trying to go out and buy insurance on your own.
Exactly. There are numerous advantages to being part of an insurance group, and one of those is pre-existing conditions. You and I working here at MTSU, no one asked us about our pre-existing conditions when we started working. And that's, you know, one of the major issues with healthcare coverage. What do we do with someone who, you know, got sick years ago but wants to buy insurance? Private insurance obviously won't and can't insure that person because they're not a risk. It's a certainty. You know there's going to be a high payout when you're running an insurance company, so insurance companies will stay away from people with pre-existing conditions. Mm-hmm. Whereas a co-op, if they wanted to allow those people, they could. Now, they would have to charge the whole group more premiums to do it, in order to remain profitable as a business.
Mm-hmm. Now, would it be harder for a healthcare co-op to get started up today if it doesn't have this long history behind it, like Tennessee Farm Bureau, because they're now one of the most influential organizations in the state, both in terms of money and in terms of politics. But if you're starting up a healthcare co-op today, wouldn't you have to establish relationships, contracts with doctors and hospitals in order to be credible enough to attract more members to it?
I'm gonna say no, and let me tell you why, because I've got a couple of recent examples from the news here about some healthcare cooperatives that have started up recently. There was an article on CNN.com, and the article I printed off doesn't have a date on it. It was sometime in August. There is a doctor in New York who helped start a restaurant workers' healthcare cooperative. Basically, the owners of restaurants pay into a fund, pay into the co-op, and the restaurant workers get to go see this doctor free of charge.
Mm-hmm.
And this was started up sometime in the last year. And it's small scale. There's not, I think it's 15 restaurants, according to the news article from CNN.com. There are 15 restaurants that are part of this. 15 restaurants and one doctor.
Right.
And then there are this large crowd of people who don't have coverage, couldn't get coverage. Typical restaurant workers don't get coverage with their job.
Right.
Well, now they've got it. And so is it hard to start? I'm thinking no, because I've got one right here in front of me that did start.
I guess they have an agreement in writing with this particular doctor,
exactly,
though, of
right,
course.
Exactly.
They make it nice and legal.
Absolutely. All the lawyers, anything you've got to do to start a regular business, you've got to do. You've got to get the contracts, the lawyers, the loans, all that paperwork is still there.
Yeah.
A co-op is a business. It has to run like any business, and it's got to it's got to be profitable like any business. And if your listeners could see, I'm doing the little quotation marks in the air when I say profitable. I don't like to use the word profit when I talk about a co-op, because co-ops are not designed to make a profit.
Right.
But they're also not non-profit.
But they're designed not to go... Hopefully, they might not have a goal of making a profit, but they certainly don't want to go into the red
and have
excruciating debt problems.
Right. No business can survive if it's bleeding money. Just like with the healthcare situation, mm-hmm. A bleeding patient, the bleeding's got to be stopped in order to survive. And the word I like to use when I talk about cooperatives is positive net income.
Mm-hmm.
Right. When a cooperative generates a positive net income, that means they follow good business practices and they've made money during the year. And that positive net income is supposed to be reinvested in the business so that it can reach out and serve more new members and more patrons, or it's supposed to be handed back to the patrons in what's known as a patronage refund.
Mm-hmm.
And that means exactly what it says. If you're a patron of a co-op and the co-op makes money, you should be getting some money back at the end of the year,
okay,
a patronage refund.
I have here a list of three different models of co-ops, and I'm going to describe them. These have been used for farmers, and I want you to tell me, as an economist, which one of these do you think is the most viable, or are all three viable in different circumstances? There's a staff model in which the co-op employs the physicians and the other providers directly. There is a purchasing alliance where the farmers band together to create a pool, and then they do the negotiating with the insurers and the providers. And then there's a self-insured co-op where a bunch of similar businesses or organizations get together to increase their leverage. For example, there are school boards in Wisconsin who do it this way. Is any one of those a better economic model for providing health care than any other, or does it depend on the circumstances?
No, there's no one correct way to do that. And I suppose the analog in agriculture is a marketing cooperative. This is a cooperative that's formed to, oh, here's an example, Sun-Made Raisins, mm-hmm. right?
Okay.
What's the Cabot, the cheese, right? If you go to the local stores, you can find Cabot cheese. It's a cooperative. And basically what you can do in these scenarios, once you take this ag product and you want to try to send it to someone's table at the end of the day, there are several ways you can go about it. You can start off by processing. Mm-hmm. You can take the product from the farmer members, add value to it, you know, take the milk, turn it into cheese, and then sell it through your own distribution system. Or you can just simply negotiate a price.
Mm-hmm.
And so any of those work, and they all work. And it all kind of depends on what the co-op wants to do. So a co-op, yes, that's not a problem to turn to an insurance company and say, hey, we're a group of people that are all seeking insurance as one big group, and we would like the same rate you would give a business of this size.
Yeah.
And negotiate with them like that. That type of cooperative is useful in that it has very little overhead. Honestly, a room the size of this one with a telephone and a computer, you can run the co-op. Because all you need to do is contact the insurance companies and keep negotiating better rates.
Mm-hmm.
So you have very small staff, very small overhead. We call that a bargaining cooperative.
Okay.
Farm Bureau, we just mentioned, does actually have their own risk pool where they actually, take the money, stick it in their account, and make the payout themselves when someone files a claim. So all three of those models will work. There's no reason why they won't.
Okay. Let me go down now to some of the devil's advocate kinds of questions that people who don't think that health care co-ops would work as a national model or as an alternative to the public option would ask. And one of the things that I've seen brought up is that while they are used in relatively small groups, in rural areas, they wonder if a healthcare co-op would work as well in an urban area where the types, maybe it has a higher crime rate, for example. So the type of risk and the degree of risk that an insurer would have to consider on his actuarial tables would be a lot higher, certainly a lot different than a farmer would experience in his neck of the woods.
So The basic thrust of that argument is that works down in the country, but it won't work here in the city.
That's the basic thrust of one argument, yeah.
Right. Well, that's a real good question, and I really don't think that it really makes any kind of a difference. And again, using the Farm Bureau here as an example, they started off providing their health care coverage and other types of insurance to people in rural areas,
mm-hmm.
Because these people could not get insurance from a private firm because they were different. Because, well, they live off in the country where they're a long way from medical treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And they live off in the country and they operate with all this machinery and they have animals that can run rampant and cause injuries. And so these individuals weren't seen as a risk that private insurers wanted to take. And so it seems to me that it's kind of the opposite argument. The co-op's there to pick up the people who aren't getting insurance somewhere else. Mm-hmm. That's what they're basically there for. There's some reason why the insurance companies don't want to use that, don't want to insure that individual. And that's what the co-op can kind of step forward and do. I really don't see there being a difference in people rural versus urban in that respect. I don't really see that argument has much weight.
Okay. Here's a question in between the devil's advocate questions, just for informational purposes. Could a doctor who serves a co-op still see patients that don't belong to that co-op?
I don't really see why not. I'm thinking this one doctor here in New York, if he's only got 15 restaurants that work that are inside the co-op, unless they're really large restaurants, I doubt that he has enough work to keep himself busy.
Right.
And again, that all boils down to the contracts that the doctors design with the co-op. Again, these would all be private businesses that kind of get to set up however they want to do it.
So the doctor would not have to limit his potential pool of customers
or patients. I don't see why not.
Okay. If a doctor, here's back to the devil's advocate again. If a doctor is, say he works in an HMO, mm-hmm. and he's got a flat fee for service kind of arrangement where the more money he makes, it's like a volume business, mm-hmm. you know. And this is a complaint that a lot of patients have with HMOs, is that there's no interpersonal relationship with the physician anymore. It's just the more patients he sees, the more money he makes, so he's going to see you and pay as little attention to you as absolutely humanly possible so he can rake in more bucks. And if he's already earning money that way, why then, for anything other than ethical or ideological reasons, would he get involved in a co-op type of arrangement? I'm speaking strictly economically now.
From the standpoint of just looking at profit, bottom
right.
line for the doctor, the doctor's income.
Yeah.
I really don't know, but here's a way to kind of think about it. If you are consuming a product and you decide you don't like it, or you decide the price isn't fair, you can vote with your dollars, make an economic vote, and go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. The member of a co-op basically gets three types of votes. They get two economic votes and one democratic vote as a member and owner of the co-op. The first one is they get to have the pleasure of providing the equity for the co-op. Mm-hmm. So that exam table doesn't belong to the doctor or the doctor's office. It belongs to the guy sitting on the table.
Is that true of all the equipment, everything in the office?
If, for example, the doctor's office was started by the co-op, it was a cooperative office. So we're assuming we have a doctor here who works for the co-op. He's in the co-op's building and is employed by the co-op, mm-hmm. right? So the co-op owns the building in this scenario. Okay. So that exam table doesn't belong to the doctor. It belongs to the guy on the table, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
The guy on the table is the customer and the boss, and owns the equipment. Mm-hmm. And it would seem to me that if I were a doctor and the boss who owns the exam table was my patient, that I would pay him a little bit more attention than just the average person who walked in off the street.
That's provided that you've got a co-op with that particular kind
exactly,
of a model.
Right.
Would it be difficult for a group of average people to scrape together the startup capital for that model of a kind of co-op where they owned the business, they owned the building, they owned the tables, they owned the x-ray machines, they owned everything in it. And obviously that would give them, like you said, more control. But can they get the money to start it?
That is often the number one factor in preventing a co-op with that particular model mm-hmm. from forming. The way I like to put it when I tell my students, there are some cooperatives that ask for a significant upfront cost.
Mm-hmm.
And these cooperatives work well once they get started because the members have a very large buy-in.
Yeah.
They've made a significant investment in this co-op. They're looking at reaping equity returns on the investment. They're looking at reaping cost savings and patronage refunds. And they get, you know, some massive benefits out of this. Well, let's give an example of this. I was using as a case study a sheep co-op that's located out in the western part of our country around Montana and such.
Okay.
And I was explaining to my students about the massive upfront costs that these sheep producers had to pay in order to get the right to deliver their sheep to this co-op for processing. And this group of students is looking at this dollar amount saying, why would anyone do that? Well, let's just sit down and go through the math then. And we went through this process and showed them that the sheep producer is getting more money by selling to the co-op.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it's more than what they're paying in, they'll do it,
right.
If that makes sense. If it makes sense from an economic decision, they'll do it, assuming they've got access to the capital.
Right.
So what maybe you might see is maybe not individuals forming co-ops like this, but businesses forming co-ops like this, where the business has access to the capital that the individual might not. And that's oftentimes what we see as we look at the examples I brought in with me today of health cooperatives.
Okay. Back to another informational question. Would a co-op, healthcare co-op, want to have arrangements with a variety? Would they want to stick to general practitioners, family practitioners, or would they want to have a large array of specialists falling under the co-op model? And if they don't have the specialist, or they can't afford to have the specialist under that model, and the family care physician has to refer you to the specialists, then do they encounter prices that are way outside of the co-op's range, and do you need private insurance to cover the specialist, or do you have to pay that out of pocket?
Again, that would depend on what the individual co-op decides to set up.
Yeah.
And I can see how that would be an issue and a problem with trying to get a co-op set up. That's definitely an issue. You hire a family practitioner, and everyone who's a member of the co-op can go see this individual, but all of a sudden someone needs an MRI, and we don't have one here.
Right.
What do you do about the MRI? Well, obviously you'd want to plan for that, and you'd want to contract with someone who had access to the specialist. I think that's probably a large reason why the Farm Bureau uses the model they do. They use the same preferred provider network that a third-party insurer uses to administer the plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, it would depend on exactly what the co-op wanted to do. This is the kind of the beauty of it is the individuals can get together and they can decide, well, what do we want? And they can have someone ask them that question and make the decision. Well, do we want to just have a small one that can cover those doctor's office visits and let people buy their own major medical insurance plan, that insurance plan that's there to cover them when they get cancer and have hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of bills, and we're going to provide office visits through our co-op. The individual co-op can set that up and decide what they want.
Yeah. If you were advising somebody, if somebody came to you and said, I think we ought to start our own little healthcare co-op right here. Nothing big, nothing fancy, just, I have a group of, people who I've been talking about it over coffee with down at the cafe or around the kitchen table, and how would you advise them to go about obtaining the information they need to get started if they don't have any idea about how to set it up?
Okay. Well, there are several things you can do. First of all, you'll need to find a lawyer that's an expert on starting a business on corporate law that has expertise in cooperatives.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing you're going to want to do. You'll want to see if you can find a co-op expert. Come ask me. I'll sit and talk with you about what co-ops are and do some consulting that way.
Mm-hmm. That was not an advertisement, folks.
And then after that, the individuals will need to sit down with a doctor. And with maybe an insurance company representative and ask them what are the issues they're going to run into. And what they end up doing is going to be a large function of how many people they've got. If they've got a relatively small number of people, they'll probably end up devising some kind of prepaid plan that covers doctor visits. If they're able to get a very large base, then they can probably do risk pooling where they actually become the insurance company and are able to pay out claims like insurance companies do. And that's going to be a huge factor in that is going to be what how big the cooperative it is, and that leads to another kind of general point about cooperatives. There's this kind of competing force as to the size of the co-op. As the co-op gets bigger, as it has more patrons, it can capture economies of scale.
Mm-hmm.
But as the co-op gets bigger, the group becomes more heterogeneous. They become less like each other. At the core, that's harder to get along with people who are not like you, right?
So you're going to have a lot of people competing in the marketplace of ideas for how they want to run
the
co-op.
Exactly. And so there's kind of a critical mass based upon that concept. And a lot of larger cooperatives today that are out there have begun to kind of ignore the importance of their membership in that respect. And so they gradually look more and more to an outsider or to even a member who's not involved in it. They begin to look like a regular business.
The way sometimes a corporation can sometimes ignore the needs of its employees down at the lower end, or a union leadership can be out of touch with its rank and file.
Right. And this kind of leads to me, if someone were to come to me from Congress and ask me, what are your thoughts on what healthcare cooperatives look like? The first thought is that you've got to keep some kind of size limit, right? You've got to have some kind of size restriction so that the people who are in the co-op have control. You've got to have some form of excludability, meaning you would organize the co-ops around groups. They would be construction worker groups, restaurant worker groups, like the example from New York. Here is a group of people who can join this co-op, farmers, for example.
But should that size cap be governmentally mandated, and should co-ops be governmentally regulated?
Well,
that's a whole other question.
Yeah, it is a whole other question. Well, if we end up to the point where we start seeing government funding, taxpayer funding, going into co-ops in order to provide health care.
As per Conrad's suggestion. Yeah,
then if the taxpayers start providing money for cooperatives, then the taxpayers deserve oversight.
Mm-hmm.
They deserve some level of control. They deserve to have some watchdog.
Because they are, in essence, stakeholders in the situation.
Exactly, kind of stakeholders. So we've got a fourth stakeholder in the situation. Mm-hmm. So it just makes things more complicated the more stakeholders you add.
Yeah. It's a fascinating concept about which I knew absolutely nothing until the idea was brought up as a possible alternative to the public option. I knew that they existed, of course, but I had never been part of one myself. I had always had employer-provided health insurance, except when I was unemployed. The one time I was on COBRA, I found out just how valuable insurance can be. And I see you grin when you say that, because you know how expensive COBRA is. It is atrocious. The idea that anybody could afford it, let alone an unemployed person, is just absurd. And so this is part of the dialogue as we go forward, exploring all different kinds of options. We are quickly running out of time. I'll just give you an opportunity to throw anything you might like to say before we conclude.
The thing that I want to throw out is there is precedence for public support of cooperatives. If you were to open up your history book and go back and look at the New Deal, Roosevelt, in 1936, there was a little law passed called the Rural Electrification Act. And this law provided zero interest loans to nonprofit organizations and co-ops to run power lines. If you are, if you're in Rutherford County, not in Murfreesboro, but in Rutherford County, you're getting your energy from a cooperative. They're providing, they own the power lines. You own the power lines because you're a member of the co-op. And so I think that if cooperatives become a part of the public choice, something like that is going to be a major element, in my opinion. Something like that should be the major element. You find a group of individuals that want to start a co-op, that see a need that they can address collectively as a group, and they go through a process of applying for one of these low-interest loans from the government. And guess what? Low-interest loans, they get paid back.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so when the loans get paid back, that's going to reduce taxpayer costs. And so the individuals use the loans for startup money to get moving, and then as the co-op, if it's well managed, it will begin to make some positive net income that can be used to repay that loan. And I think that type of model could work if our policymakers wanted to use cooperatives as an option. And again, there's historical precedence for that. It's been done before, and guess what? It worked.
Okay.
And it worked real well.
Dr. Justin Gardner of the Department of Agribusiness and Agriscience, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at this same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com. And we're also available on iTunes.